Here we go, guys. When we last left David, he had slain a giant, and he was dealing with the stress of success, but now we enter into a time in his life over the next several messages where there's going to be considerable conflict. And I thought about conflict this week, and I noted that conflict is not usually between strangers. At least the most stressful kinds of conflict. The most stressful kinds of conflict are between roommates, are between people in your own club, people in your own organization, people that you work with, maybe even people in your own family. Usually the worst kinds of conflict are not with strangers, but with people that we know all too well. Maybe you can relate to the story. It was in Fargo, North Dakota. A man was driving a hearse, and there was a casket in the back, and 41 men were in cars behind the hearse in single file. And in the front seat of the hearse was the driver and a German Shepherd dog. Well, a policeman pulled this man over and said, "Listen, fellow, we don't have any of these kooky parades out here. This is not California." And the guy said, "This isn't a parade, this is a funeral. My mother-in-law was killed by this German Shepherd dog here. He bit her to death." The officer thought a while and he said, "Well, I guess you wouldn't want to rent that dog out, would you?" He said, "Well, sure, get in line." I don't write these, I just read these. Assault from an enemy is more bitter when that enemy was once a friend. Isn't that true? David's greatest enemy was not Goliath, but it was a man that was once his biggest fan. And today we're going to see how a monarch became a maniac. You can't study the life of David without studying the life of Saul, and there are a few characters in Scripture that strike me as more tragic than Saul. And you can't really appreciate how tragic his life is unless you appreciate who the man could have been. And he's a classic illustration, in my opinion, of what can happen when a person is arrogant and disobedient. God did not think Saul would be the trial run and let him wear on the people and then bring in his real man. Samuel said to Saul when he sinned, "You have not kept the command of the Lord your God. If you would have kept it, God would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time." And what he became is tragic when you consider what he could have been. God was for Saul. God wanted to make Saul's kingdom last forever, but he disobeyed God, and the results were he was unhappy, he was suspicious, he was depressed, he was paranoid. There was absolutely no harmony in his life. Of course, that is implied because the man would get so depressed and he would become so overcome that there were times when the only relief that he could actually get was when David would come and play on his harp and sing to him the songs that David had written about God. And what that indicates is that Saul's real problem is that he had a poor relationship with God. Now, he knew the formula, but he'd lost the reality. And I think that's something that all of us acquainted with religious things need to remember. Our problem is not that we forget the formulas. Saul knew them. Saul, his vocabulary, read it. He knew how to say, "God be with you." He knew how to say, "Praise the name of the Lord." But the reality of a relationship that meant something had ceased to exist. Now, when you have a poor vertical relationship, it always has horizontal ramifications. At least that's true in my own life. When I fail to pray like I should, or study the Bible like I need to, or commune with God like I should be over a period of time, every single time I start to see the relationships that are on the horizontal plane begin to unravel. In Saul's case, his distance from God manifested itself in jealousy toward David. He got all upset because the new hit song in Israel was, Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands. Just a thought, by the way, for those of you who care about popularity. One reason you are going to be miserable most of your life is that popularity is always superseded by somebody else. I don't care how great of an athlete you may be. If you keep playing long enough, you will be booed, and there will be a crowd wanting someone else to be put in your place. And just ask any politician if they can stay on top of the game forever. Nobody stays on top forever. And if you're going to get caught up in that, then you're going to be frustrated. Now, if you have a good relationship with God, then you handle those kinds of things. But if you don't have a good relationship with God, then it starts to break down on the horizontal level. And one of the ways that it breaks down first is jealousy. And what do you do when you feel jealousy coming on? Well, you need to realize that your real problem is that your vertical relationship is not where it needs to be. So you need to take it to God. You need to confess it. And you need to ask for God's help. I would say, Ben, just take off all of the other stuff. Just turn everything off and I got a loud enough voice. They're going to hear me. But Saul didn't do that. Saul allowed jealousy to eat at him until only murder would satisfy it. And that's what will happen in your heart if you don't deal with jealousy when it starts to show its ugly head. If you let it live in your heart long enough, you will develop the heart of a murderer. You see, what our text is going to show us this morning is not just that Saul has this personal problem with David. Saul has a problem with God. He is deliberately attempting to thwart God's purposes. When Saul did not destroy the Amalekites like God had asked him to do so, but instead he allowed the king and some of the choice livestock to live, Samuel the prophet came to him and said, "You have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you over king of Israel." And Saul got upset, and remember, he grabbed Samuel's robe and it tore. And Samuel turned and he said, "The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today, and he's given it to one of your neighbors, to one better than you." That was the word of the Lord from the prophet to King Saul. The kingdom had been taken from him, and it wasn't originally God's plan. Wow. God's plan had been to make Saul's kingdom last forever, but Saul blew it. And it was removed from him. And that was all before Saul knew that David even existed. That was before really anybody knew that David existed. And for all this time now, Saul has been kind of on the lookout for this one that God is going to give his kingdom to. And then, lo and behold, comes the shepherd. And look what Saul says to himself in verse 8 of 1 Samuel 18. Saul was very angry. This refrain galled him. "They've credited David with tens of thousands," he thought, "but me only with thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom?" What has happened there for the first time is that Saul is realizing David is the one. This is the one that Samuel was talking about. He didn't recognize him at first because he was so young. And Saul, in his wickedness, decided that he was going to find a way to keep God from doing what he said he was going to do. And sometime during that night, he came up with a thought that was going to solve his problems. You see, a dead man can't reign. And Saul thought to himself, "God said he's going to give my kingdom away. He's going to give it to David, but not if David is dead." Now, hold on. Give me a second.
I'm just going to see if this is a problem, Ben.
So, it's a delicate situation. Saul wants to remove this threat, but he wants to do it in such a way that the blame doesn't come back on himself. So what we're going to see through a series of plots where a part of Saul is wanting to, not through direct murder, but get David killed. And there were five of them total we're going to see this morning. The first one is in 1 Samuel 18, verse 10. And it says this: the next day, an evil spirit from God came forcefully upon Saul. He was prophesying in his house while David was playing the harp, as he usually did. Saul had a spear in his hand, and he hurled it, saying to himself, "I'll pin David to the wall." But David eluded him twice. The next day, what next day? Well, this is the day after Saul realized that the kingdom was going to go to David. Now, it sounds like this is an attempt at direct murder, but there's more a more subtle thing going on here than just that, because I believe that Saul was feigning insanity. His plan was to kill David and then plead temporary insanity. After all, this evil spirit had come on him, and only under the influence of this evil spirit did he try to murder David. And no doubt, a little time later, he would tell the court, "If I had been in my right mind, I never would have done this. That evil spirit had come over me again." I believe that's what not only he said, but his court believed it, and actually so did David. Because notice, David stays in the court. And I don't know about you, but if a guy tries to pin me twice to the wall with a spear and then says, "You know, I'm not in my right mind," I would have left. But David trusted Saul. In fact, we'll see next week, it's not until the third time that Saul tries to spear David that David finally says, "You know, I think he's serious." So plan number one was to feign insanity and have it look like Saul wasn't really responsible for what happened. Plan number two is deceptive promotion. Now look with me at verse 12 in chapter 18. It says, "Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with David but had left Saul. So he sent David away from him and gave him command over 1,000 men. And David led troops in their campaigns. And everything he did, he had great success because the Lord was with him." When Saul saw how successful he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he led them in their campaigns. So, question, if Saul is afraid of David, and why is he giving this kingdom over to David by giving him more power and more authority and letting him have this promotion? Why did he put him over 1,000 men and honor him in such a way? Two reasons. Number one, I think out of sight, out of mind, he's just trying to get him out of town. But the main reason, he's secretly hoping, I believe, that David would get killed in battle. And that way, he has eliminated David, and it looks like he's a great guy because David gets this great honor. And everybody says, "You know, it's too bad about David, but boy, Saul, what a great king." That was the plan. But the plan did not work because David wasn't killed. He was only met with success because the text says, because the Lord was with him. And let me just preach on that phrase for a little while. I want you to notice, when we study Old Testament characters, we need to remember that the success or the failure of their lives was not always in their own abilities, but in their relationship to God. Why was David a successful warrior? Because he had great training in battle and war? No. Because he's bigger and stronger than all the other soldiers? No way. He had success because the Lord was with him. Another example, all of my life I remember hearing how big Samson was. He's the strongest man in all of Israel, and he's bigger than any guy. Do you know nowhere in the book of Judges does it say that Samson was big? I don't even know where we got the idea. If you look, when Samson performed his deeds of great strength, it was when the text would say these words, "The Spirit of the Lord came upon Samson." That's why he could do it. Why did David meet with success in battle? Because the Lord was with him, and the Lord was not with Saul. Third plan, public disgrace. This is interesting. Look with me at verse 17 of chapter 18. It says this. Saul said to David, "Here is my older daughter, Merab. I will give her to you in marriage. Only serve me bravely and fight the battles of the Lord." For Saul said to himself, "I will not raise a hand against him. Let the Philistines do that." But David said to Saul, "Who am I? And what is my family or my father's clan in Israel that I should become the king's son-in-law?" So when the time came for Merab, Saul's daughter, to be given to David, she was given in marriage to Adriel of Mahola. You see, at this point, David still hasn't figured out that Saul is after him. He still thinks that Saul is on his side. Now, what's going on here? Well, the way that this makes sense to me is that Saul approaches David and tells him he wants him to be a part of his family. But David comes from a poor family. He doesn't have the money to pay the price for a bride. First off, he shouldn't have even had to pay any money. I'll talk about that in a second, but let me just say right now, David has already paid the price. But this is what happened. Saul went ahead and he set the plans for the marriage because the text says, when David was to marry Merab, but on that very day, Saul said instead to all of the people, "David's right. He's not good enough to be my son-in-law. He's just too poor." And so he gave this girl to another man, and all of the nation knew that the only reason she did not marry David was because Saul decided that David did not have enough to be a part of his family. And he publicly disgraced David. Now, he had a good excuse. He could say, well, after all, David even admitted he doesn't have enough money. Why is he trying to do this? What is he trying to do? He's trying to goad David into bitterness and try to get him to retaliate so that if he says anything evil or does anything evil against the king, then Saul can arrest him and eliminate him. And Saul will come out on top of the whole thing looking good. He can say, well, after all, I was just trying to help this young man, and he turned on me. But Saul's problem is that he keeps expecting David to do what Saul would do. I hope sometime in your life you will have the experience where someone in the world who lives a pagan lifestyle will mistreat you, and they expect you to take it like they take it. And then they come to you later and tell you, I don't understand you. You didn't handle that like I thought you would. And then you get to say, you know why? Because of the Lord. Well, three plans have failed, so we come to the next plan. Plan four was simply to let the enemy do it. Read with me, picking up in verse 20 of 1 Samuel 18. Now, Saul's daughter Michal was in love with David. And when they told Saul about it, he was pleased. I will give her to him, he thought, so that she may be a snare to him and so that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. So Saul said to David, now, you have a second opportunity to become my son-in-law. Then Saul ordered his attendants, speak to David privately and say, look, the king is pleased with you and his attendants all like you. Now, become his son-in-law. They repeated these words to David, but David said, do you think it is a small matter to become the king's son-in-law? I'm only a poor man and little known. When Saul's servants told him what David had said, Saul replied, say to David, the king wants no other price for the bride than 100 Philistine foreskins. Yuck! To take revenge on his enemies. Saul's plan was to have David fall by the hands of the Philistines. When the attendants told David these things, he was pleased to become the king's son-in-law. So before the allotted time elapsed, David and his men went out and killed 200 Philistines. And he brought their foreskins, yuck, and presented the full number of them to the king so that he might become the king's son-in-law. Then Saul gave his daughter Michal in marriage. When Saul realized that the Lord was with David and that his daughter Michal loved David, Saul became still more afraid of him and remained his enemy the rest of his days. The Philistine commanders continued to go out to battle, and as often as they did, David met with more success than the rest of Saul's officers, and his name became well known. Can you imagine having a father-in-law that wanted to kill you? Yes, I can. But that is a story for another time. Saul had a very subtle scheme. He was always making sure that he would end up looking good. He was going to have it look like he's trying to help David. But his plan was that when David would go out to kill the Philistines to pay the price, well, 1 against 100, there's just no way he can do that. Well, the problem for Saul was David had actually already paid the bride price. Remember what he said when Saul himself was too afraid to go fight Goliath? He told the army that the king would give to the man that killed Goliath, number one, great wealth, number two, the daughter of the king, and number three, his father's family would be exempted from taxes. Saul was a liar. He didn't give David his daughter in marriage, number one, and number two, how come David don't have any money? He was supposed to be wealthy by now. But David said, I'm a poor man. You see, Saul had not kept his promises. David had already paid that bride price. David shouldn't have had to kill a single Philistine to marry this girl. But David did not argue about it, even though I'm sure Saul wanted him to argue about it. He went out and he did twice what was expected of him. And even though, again, the plan was to eliminate David while making Saul look good, the plan backfires. And now Saul is desperate, so he resorts to his most extreme and evil plan yet. Let his son do it. And you don't get much lower than this. Look at the first verse of chapter 19 with me. Saul told his son Jonathan and all the attendants to kill David. That's about as low as you can get. Saul was willing, in order to save his own throne, to let his own son bear the guilt and blame for murder. That's the talk of a desperate and sick man. Read with me as it continues. But Jonathan was very fond of David and warned him, "My father Saul is looking for a chance to kill you. Be on your guard tomorrow morning. Go into hiding and stay there. I will go out and stand with my father in the field where you are. I'll speak to him about you and will tell you what I find out." Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, "Let not the king do wrong to his servant David. He's not wronged you. And what has he done? What he has done has benefited you greatly. He took his life in his hands when he killed the Philistine. The Lord won a great victory for all Israel, and you saw it and were glad. Why then would you do wrong to an innocent man like David by killing him for no reason?" Saul listened to Jonathan and took this oath: "As surely as the Lord lives, David will not be put to death." So Jonathan called David and told him the whole conversation, and he brought him to Saul, and David was with Saul as before. And I wish the story ended right there, but it doesn't. But I just can't close this morning without praising Jonathan. The incredible thing to me is that Jonathan had more cause to be jealous of David than Saul did. David really is not a threat to Saul. As long as Saul is alive, he's going to be the king. David is a threat to Jonathan, because the typical way things would go back then is you waited until the old man would die and then you overthrew the boy and you took over the throne. But Saul is jealous. Jonathan is not. And Jonathan sees that there is a distance between Saul and David, and he takes it upon himself to bring this relationship back together that has been severed by jealousy. You think we need more Jonathans in our churches today? Let's get real personal. Because I am wondering how many of you know relationships between Christians that have been severed by jealousy. And if you know somebody who is jealous of somebody else, would you then be a Jonathan and be brave enough to step in there and try to repair that thing? Jealousy is real. Jealousy turned a monarch into a maniac. It still does. How are you going to deal with it? Well, let me give you a couple thoughts. Here's the first. Confront it for what it is. A symptom. It is a symptom. The fact is, natural endowments and advantages have not been equally distributed. Let's face it. Some people are going to be better looking than other people. It's a cross that I have to bear. Some people are going to be singing better than other people. Some people are going to be better musicians. Some people are going to be better speakers than others. Some people are just born with charisma, and some never get it their whole life. We were not all little robots when we were born. We were born different, with different abilities and different advantages. And consequently, comparisons then are inevitable. We spend most of our lives comparing ourselves to other people. And if we don't measure up at times, usually jealousy can creep in. But when you foster jealousy, what you are really doing is you are striking at a substitute. You see, jealousy is basically an assault against God. When you get upset because someone else is healthy or better looking and you're not, you might not come out and say this, but what you're really doing is you are attacking God for not making you better looking or not making you healthy. When you are jealous because one lady has more children than she actually needs to have, and you don't have any kids and you haven't had any kids, and that causes you to have a distaste for that woman, you're really striking at God. Now, it may never come to your thinking, but that's actually what's going on when you are jealous because someone else gets a promotion or the job and you did not get that. The problem is not the other person. The problem is actually you. Jealousy is a spiritual dilemma that manifests itself in a distance between you and God that needs to be fixed. Because when it is right with you and God, you can accept the fact that people are not going to be exactly alike. And you can deal with that. But when you are not right with God, you're going to spend a lot of your life trying to fight a symptom, striking at a substitute, and that, my friends, is a miserable way to live. So confront it for what it is, a symptom. But secondly, let's not rationalize. Confess it for what it is, a sin. My wife read this at the beginning of the service. For since there is jealousy and quarreling among you, are you not worldly? Jealousy is a worldly attitude. There's no other way to describe it. You have two choices. Number one, you can allow it to eat at your heart, or you can have the heart of a murderer. Or number two, you can extinguish that spark from hell in a sea of prayer. But I'm not kidding. If you do not take action to confess your jealousy, you will get a very cold heart. I want to share something with you that illustrates this better than I actually could. It seems there was once two men, a Mr. Wilson and a Mr. Thompson, and they were both seriously ill in the same room of a very large hospital. It was a small room, just two beds, two little lockers, and there was a window on the wall, and there was a door that led out to the hall. They were both very ill, so there was no TV, no radio. They just laid there still in their beds. Now, Mr. Thompson was allowed once a day to sit up for about an hour in his bed to help the fluid that was in his lungs drain out. Well, his bed was by the window. Now, the men loved to talk because that's about all they could do. They talked about their wives, talked about their children and their grandchildren, what they did during the war, talked about their careers, their hobbies, the places that they had been. Well, Mr. Wilson loved the outdoors. Mr. Thompson knew that. So every day when they would prop him up on his bed and he could look out the window, he would tell Mr. Wilson what was outside because he could just see how happy it would make him. And apparently there was a park below, and Mr. Thompson would talk about the lake that was down there and the ducks that were on the lake and the little kids that would bring bread to feed the ducks, and he'd share about the families that would be there in the park on a picnic, or the bike riders, the people flying their kites, or the young couple walking in the trees holding hands. Mr. Wilson just loved to hear all of this. Well, one day Mr. Wilson thought to himself, why does he get the bed by the window and I don't? Well, the more he thought about it, the worse he felt about it. And he didn't really know how to deal with it. And as time went on, he got to where that's all he could actually think about. Why couldn't he be by the window? And he turned sour and bitter. Fact is, it was getting so bad, couldn't even sleep at night thinking about it. Well, one night as he was laying awake, and all of a sudden Mr. Thompson started to cough real bad. The coughing was horrible. It seemed like the fluid was building up in his lungs. And he could tell that Mr. Thompson was fumbling there in his bed in the dark, trying to find the call button for the nurse to come and help him. But he just couldn't find it while he was laying there in the dark. And Mr. Wilson just laid there in the dark. He didn't make a move. And all of a sudden, the coughing stopped. And the breathing stopped. And Mr. Wilson just laid there. Well, the next morning when the nurse came to give them their baths, she found Mr. Thompson had died. And so she took him out without much of a fuss. It took his body away as quietly as possible. And as soon as it seemed decent to do so, Mr. Wilson said, could I have the bed by the window? So they took him and they moved him over there to that bed and they tucked him in. And then they left the room, and after he was sure that everybody was gone, and he used what little strength he had and propped himself up on his elbow so he could look out that window, and that window faced a blank brick wall. He had the heart of a murderer. That's a parable. I would not have shared it, except it's just too true not to know. Stand up. I want to pray over you.